Merci. Thank you for the introduction. Let me just first say that I want to thank Professor Haroche for inviting me to speak here today. It's a great honor and a pleasure. I'm sorry that I cannot speak in French, but I appreciate your allowing me to speak in my native language, English. So I'm going to talk about light and single molecules and tell you how they can be used as tiny nanoscale light sources to look inside cells in a way that had not been possible before. So let's start out by thinking about microscopy. In fact, in almost all biomedical laboratories and hospitals and other laboratories, you find a light microscope. And why is that? Fluorescence microscopy is a very powerful tool, simply because we can pump molecules and cause them to emit light and use that to learn a great deal about biology. So for example, here is a cell that 10 micron scale, but different objects inside the cell are labeled with different fluorescent molecules, different colors. One color shows mitochondria, another color actin, another color DNA. And this power of light and molecules allows us to specifically label different targets with excellent signal to background in a relatively non-invasive way. And that's why these particular microscopes are used so often. They're compatible with live cells, but at the same time, cells are filled with very tiny objects, 10 nanometers in size. Can we see them? So let's take a look at different spatial scales that would be of interest. And I'm particularly interested in something called resolution. That means distinguishing two objects that are close together. Well, your hair, one hair on your head, is about 100 microns in size here, 100 microns in size. And you see that cells, for example, 10 microns, bacteria, 1 micron, viruses, 100 nanometers. Here is a protein, 10 nanometers. Here is a single molecule, 1 nanometer. And if we went further, that would be about the size of an atom. So I'm going to be talking about light sources that are this size. But you want to see structures in all of these other objects. Now, you can use X-ray or nuclear magnetic resonance or electron microscopy to achieve very, very high resolution. But these methods are difficult for live cells. On the other hand, light microscopy, as I just described, is non-invasive and has specific labeling. The problem has been because light microscopy in the visible has a wavelength of about 500 nanometers. Light microscopy previously could only extract detail up to something called the diffraction limit, which I will describe in a few minutes. In other words, you could not resolve structures closer together than 200 nanometers. So the new revolution, in fact, something that was recognized by the Nobel Prize last year, is something called super resolution, which allows us to use light microscopy to push beyond this fundamental limit to get resolution at 100 nanometers down to 10 nanometers and below. So this is the revolution in optical microscopy that has occurred that I want to describe. But it's based, for my part, on single molecules. Now, to see single molecules, to visualize them with light, in fact, this is a wonderful thing to describe this year because this is the International Year of Light, 2015. And the optical detection of molecules stands on the shoulders of many giants. For example, electromagnetic waves from Maxwell and many others, just as described by Professor Haroche yesterday. Quantum mechanics, Einstein, Planck, Schrödinger, and others. And then finally, chemical structure and the knowledge of molecules and how molecules interact with light. All of those things are needed to do what I'm going to describe. But once you can detect a single molecule, you can make these sorts of images. These are all images of single molecules. And I want to tell you how we do this in a few moments. In fact, in 1985, in the mid-1980s, I started out to try to detect single molecules. But there was a problem. Even though Erwin Schrödinger, a brilliant physicist, was one of the founders of quantum mechanics, and he did his beautiful work in the mid-1920s, in 1952, he said the following: "We never experiment with just one electron or atom or small molecule. And some experiments we may assume that we do, but it is fair to state, etc., that we are not experimenting with single particles any more than we can raise dinosaurs in the zoo." So this was a problem, right? And others thought that it was impossible to detect a single molecule. So we managed to do it, and I won't tell you all the details of how it's done, but first let me try to describe why it's interesting to see a single molecule. Why would you like to see a single molecule, with a couple of analogies? So here's one analogy. Think of a mile-high stadium. This is where football is played by the Denver Broncos team, okay? So here's the stadium. And if you take an average picture of this stadium, you see mostly Denver Broncos, orange and blue color everywhere. But if you can look very closely at the system, then you might see some surprises. For example, here are some individuals who are Green Bay fans. That's the other team that they were playing that day. This idea, of course, can apply to any other kind of sport, like football, softball, and soccer, and so on. So you can see how this could apply to the teams that you like. But the experiments that we're doing are more than just detecting the rare individuals. And let me explain a little bit more with a different analogy. If you will, now think about baseball. So here's an analogy to baseball. In 2004, the World Series, which was the big game at the end of the season, the champions were the Boston Red Sox. And so my student highlighted the Boston Red Sox here, of course. But here is information about the various teams that were playing that year. This is the team batting average. Now, the batting average is the probability that a player will hit the ball and get a run, okay, or get a hit. And so if they hit 50% of the time, half of the time, their batting average would be 0.5. So here's the number for the whole team. Now, you know this number is averaged over everyone in the team, and we call this an ensemble measurement. Beautiful word from French, of course. but now we also know that you can measure this property for every team player. And so if you do that, measuring it for every player, then you can make a plot like this: the number of players versus their batting averages, and we place bars here according to how many players have these batting averages. And so this is the measurement that's based on individuals, based on, if you think, single molecules for a moment. Notice that many of the players have batting averages here. But notice also that there's something strange going on down here. Who are these players that have very poor batting averages? That means they can't hit very well. Well, you may know that these, of course, are the pitchers. They can throw the ball, but they can't hit it very much. All right? So this illustrates that if you can measure a property for every member, then you can make a plot like this and see if there are strange behaviors that you did not expect just from the average. So we translate this idea, basically, from baseball to the nanoscale. So after much research in the 1980s, the first experiment to detect a single molecule was done with my postdoc, Lothar Kador, and I, when I was working at the IBM Research Division in San Jose, California. And we measured the optical absorption of a single molecule. So it was a great step forward, and it was based on pentosine molecules. So pentosine, 5 rings, in a transparent host of paraterphenyl. A year later, another important experiment occurred from the laboratory of Michel Horry in Bordeaux, where they also detected a single molecule's absorption of light, but used a different method detecting the emitted light, the fluorescence. And this was an incredibly important advance in the field. So I want to now talk to you a little bit more about this fluorescence idea. What is fluorescence really, and how can we observe it ourselves with your own eyes? Briefly, how do molecules that are fluorescent interact with light? So you want to think of, first of all, the absorption of light. A light coming in, or a photon, like Einstein said, will pump the molecule from the ground state to an excited state. Then a molecule typically relaxes a bit, and after the relaxation, the energy spacing is smaller, so that when the molecule emits light, it emits light of lower energy or longer wavelength. So if you pump with green light, then you can get orange light out, for example. So now I want to demonstrate this idea. I want to show you what this really looks like. And so what I'm doing for this demonstration is to simply take a few simple components. I have here a vial that has just water in it, clear water, transparent water. And I have an orange highlighter, okay? And you want to make sure, if you do this, get an orange highlighter that's the cheap one. Don't get the expensive one or the no smudge. You want to be able to let it dissolve in water, okay? So now, here's what I will do. I'll just simply open the vial and stick the highlighter into the water a little bit. Just touch the water briefly for just a second. All right, I'm done. I don't need the highlighter anymore. And now there's a few molecules in this liquid. But can you see them? You can't see them very well, can you? All right, so I'll take a small green 5-milliwatt laser, and I'll show you what the molecules look like. So now, please turn the lights off, will you? Please turn the lights off. And I want to also make this turn off. Here we go. Okay, that's pretty dark. I think you can see this. So now, all I'm going to do is to shine the laser beam through the liquid. Voila. So you see light coming out of the liquid. Merci. That's the light from the molecules, lumière, from the molecules. And notice it's orange. I hope you can see that it's orange-colored, just like I said. Orange-colored, although I'm sending in green light. But what's coming out is orange. That's because the molecules are absorbing green and emitting orange. Even the transmitted light, if I send the beam through here, you can see that the light coming through is still green. Okay? So the molecules are only taking a small amount of the light and converting it to this orange light that you can see very clearly. It's like a lightsaber. So this is fluorescence. Fluorescence from molecules. Okay? Now you can turn the lights back on. So what we do in our experiments basically is to dilute the molecules. Instead of having roughly 10 raised to the power 23 molecules here, we dilute to just one molecule. And in fact, then there is light coming from that one molecule. You might think that it's very, very weak, and of course it is very weak. It's roughly only 10,000 photons coming out per second. But the amazing fact is that you can see the light from a single molecule with your own eyes. If you come to my microscope or come to a microscope in France where they do single molecule experiments, you can see the tiny points of light coming from individual molecules with your own eyes. And this is an amazing fact. It shows how sensitive your eyes are to very, very dim light, as well as the bright sunlight that's outside sometimes. So, but we, of course, use fancy detectors. So in our experiments, what we typically do is to think of this kind of a setup. Here's a sample, it might be a cell, and what we have are these fluorescent molecules. Here's some examples of fluorescent molecules. Rhodamines, another one with a complicated name, even something called the fluorescent protein that you heard a little bit about yesterday. I'll talk more about it in a moment. And those are placed inside, usually attached to the structure of interest, usually attached to another protein that you want to observe. So these are used as markers or beacons as to where the objects are that you want to see. We focus the laser down to the smallest possible spot. And something important is that we cannot focus the laser beam to an infinitely small spot. The spot will have a minimum size defined by the wavelength divided by 2 times something called the numerical aperture, which is about 1, roughly half the wavelength, 200 to 250 nanometers. So this spot is very large compared to the individual molecules, but if you dilute the molecules a lot, if you make them far apart, then you will pump and detect and see only one molecule at a time. So this kind of an experiment allows us to take these kinds of images of single molecules. I've switched to a different molecule now, doesn't matter. Here is the camera picture where I'm showing by color what large signals versus small signals. And then if I take this whole plot and turn it on its side, tilt it down into 3 dimensions, then you can see that that molecule looks a bit like a little mountain, okay? So that's what our camera sees, but your eyes could see the same thing. Now, let me give you some examples of what we can do with single molecules, because once you could detect these objects, then you can see them doing amazing things, especially in polymers and crystals, but also in cells. So let's think of a cell here. And this cell is alive, and here's a side view of the cell. We're interested in proteins that are in the membrane of the cell, transmembrane proteins. This particular one is called MHC2, or major histocompatibility complex of type 2, one of these crazy long names, of course. this particular protein is essential to our immune system. In your cells right now, these major histocompatibility complexes are on the surface of your cells, and they typically hold a small antigen. This antigen is simply being presented to the outside in case there is a T cell that comes around and finds out whether it's a friend or a foe. All right? In this experiment, though, we labeled the antigen with a fluorescent dye, one of those molecules that's fluorescent, as I just showed you. So the light from this molecule will tell us where this one is. And that's what this camera is showing. It's showing spots of light that are coming from individual MHC2s in the membrane of the cell. But now watch what happens when I show you how things change with time. It's amazing. The behavior of the molecules in the membrane are a dance. They're moving all over the place, diffusing around in the membrane. And this is a fundamental property of all biology that's very important to the way our cells work, diffusion and thermal excitation of motion. So we can measure the movement of individual molecules and measure properties of them. You also saw in that movie that some of the molecules, after emitting for some time, they also stop emitting. They turn off, okay? And that you want to think of as photobleaching, very much like the students who buy blue jeans and make sure the blue jeans are bleached and white instead of blue. That's photobleaching, and that's the same thing going on here for these molecules. They will emit maybe a million photons and then stop. So this is, of course, a fantastic way to observe inside the cell. But I want to also talk about this other fascinating fluorescent molecule, and it's a fluorescent protein in particular, the green fluorescent protein that you heard a little bit about yesterday. And the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 2008 went to Chaofei Shimomura and Roger Chen for green fluorescent protein. Here's the structure of the protein, but the important part is this little molecule that's inside this barrel. This is the molecule. Here it is in a chemical structure. It is composed, or it's created, from several amino acids in the sequence of the fluorescent protein itself. So if you tell the cell to make this protein, the cell will automatically make this fluorescent label. And this object, then, can be covalently attached to another protein that you want to observe.
So that's the beauty of green fluorescent protein, and it has revolutionized biology. Well, it came from a jellyfish originally, this particular protein structure. But it's very, very useful now for biology. Okay, so I told you some things about the 1980s. Let's think about the 1990s. There was something amazing that also happened then regarding single molecules and now fluorescent proteins. In 1997, my postdoc and I took a look at a variant of green fluorescent protein, so-called yellow fluorescent protein, or enhanced yellow fluorescent protein, that we received from Roger Chen's lab. And what we observed were single molecules. We can detect single copies of fluorescent proteins. Wonderful. But more important were the surprises. We not only saw the image of single copies, but we also observed blinking. We observed that the individual protein will emit multiple times, but then turn off, but come back on again. Emit some more, off, on, off, on, blinking, on and off, which was a surprise. We didn't expect this to occur for fluorescent proteins. And we also observed that if you use a molecule for a long time, and so that it turns off, you think it is photobleached, we can make it turn back on again with a little bit of purple light, 405 nanometers. We can recover the light using light to control the molecule. So this is now not only light emission, but also light control of the emitting molecule. You can make the fluorescent protein then turn off again, ultimately, and restore it with a different light beam, and again and again and again, multiple times. The point here is that we could photoswitch individual molecules. Individual molecules could be controlled, whether they're emitting or not emitting. Now, it's sort of funny to recognize that here's this patent number listed up here. Why was there a patent? Well, it turned out I came from IBM research, and we were thinking about optical storage of digital data. So this patent is about storing data, storing bits of information in individual molecules of green fluorescent protein. Well, that didn't quite work out as a big application. But there are other things that we did with these properties, as I'll tell you in a moment. But I just want to show you this cartoon from 1997 in a journal called Photonic Spectra, which is something like a trade journal or a commercial journal, where they made some fun of us, you see. They made a little fun of these crazy scientists because they said, what's the story here? We'll have our computers connected to a tank of water where we have jellyfish inside the tank of water next to the computer. Good. So that is an interesting thing. They didn't realize what we would really do with these fluorescent proteins later. So that leads me to the Nobel Prize of last year, which I was happy to share with Eric Betzig and Stefan Hell. And the prize recognizes the development of super-resolved fluorescence microscopy, or super-resolution, as I was talking about. I want to explain how we do this. My work is most closely related to Eric Betzig. Stefan Hell achieved super resolution by another fascinating method. So here's the idea. We are going to try to overcome this thing called the diffraction limit. And the problem is that's a fundamental physical effect, so we really can't overcome it directly. We have to circumvent it, or we have to go around it. And I'll explain why and how we do that in a moment. Here is a small bacterial cell. Bacteria are small, maybe 2 microns in length, 500 microns across. And we have used that fluorescent protein idea to label particular proteins inside the cell. So we would like to see the structure of those molecules. What is the structure that it's making? Well, you might think all I have to do is to buy the most expensive microscope I can. Here's the most expensive microscope you can, and you don't see any structure. Things are still fuzzy. Things are still fundamentally blurry and out of focus. Why? That's coming from the fact that even though the emitters are small, like 3 nanometers in size for a fluorescent protein, the light that you detect from that small emitter looks a lot larger, looks a lot bigger on your camera. In fact, the size of the molecule is dictated by the diffraction limit, first mentioned by Ernst Abbe in the late 1800s. And the limit, or if you like the size of this molecule on the camera, looks like it's lambda, or the wavelength used, divided by 2 times the numerical aperture, this number that's on the order of 1. Roughly lambda over 2, roughly 200, 250 nanometers in the visible. And of course, this has been the limitation of optical microscopy for hundreds of years up until super resolution. When we achieve super resolution, then this is what we get. Voila. This incredible improvement in the image. Instead of this fuzzy image, with super resolution, we can observe this kind of detail. And it's not a small improvement. It's a huge improvement by a factor of 5 or more. So it's revolutionizing molecular biology. Now I want to tell you how it really works. Okay, we're going to go through the steps required to achieve super resolution. So we can do this if we simply first detect single molecules. We know how to do that already. But we have to add to that two essential ingredients. The first ingredient is super localization of single molecules. So what does that mean? Well, think for me about this little mountain. We call it a cinder cone, actually, because it's in the middle of a volcanic lake. It's in the middle of Crater Lake, Oregon. And if you have the opportunity to go there, it's very, very beautiful. Here is my scale bar that I have to show in every image. The scale bar here is 120 times 10 to the 9th nanometers. Okay? So for those of you who remember, that's really just 120 meters. But we have to use the units of nanometers, all right? So you know that if you take your cell phone, and walk up to the top of this mountain, you can record the position of the mountain very precisely. That's basically what we're doing with individual molecules. Here is an image of one molecule. You see it's like a little mountain. Its width is the diffraction limit, but we can find its position much more precisely than the width. In other words, we take an image of the single molecule, spread it out on multiple pixels of our detector, and then using a mathematical process, we can determine the position of the center to very high precision. So this is what I mean by super localization. It's not a new idea in science, but it's very powerful if you have separated single molecules in terms of finding their position accurately. The other key element is to actively control how many molecules are emitting. So this is important. Suppose this is the structure we want to see. Then we can decorate it with fluorescent molecules. So there's fluorescent labels decorating the structure. But if we turn on the laser and just let all of them emit at the same time, then each of them emits a spot like this, and they all overlap. And it's because they overlap that we see a blurry image, okay? A fundamentally out-of-focus image. So the solution to this problem is simply to use molecules that have two states. Molecules that are off and not emitting, even though we shine light on them. And also states an A state which is emissive, where the molecule emits light when we shine light on it. So it's crucial to have this. If you have such a mechanism, then you can make sure that most molecules are off at any given time in the experiment. So, for example, we first turn on only a few of them, and then you can localize these by superlocalization and find their positions. Then you, for example, photobleach them or use them up and turn on a few more, and you will get different positions, different samples of the underlying structure. Now, the method by which we control the molecules, there are many, many ways to do it, it turns out. It can be photoactivation or creating a fluorescent molecule, but it also can be molecules that blink, like I showed you before, blinking on and off. A number of mechanisms enable this idea. So you do it again and again, and ultimately what you have are many positions along the structure. And here's the final point, and it's drawing from the beauty of art and connections to the great artists. You take the positions that you found and create a pointillist reconstruction of the underlying structure. So just exactly which was invented by Surratt and Signac in the late 1880s, very similar to the time of Abbe when he said there was a diffraction limit. This is the extra resolution that's produced by a pointillist reconstruction. So this idea appeared in 2006 from Eric Betzig, called Palm, Storm by Zhuang, F. Palm, and all of these acronyms started appearing, different acronyms, all of them in some way talking about how scientists have been able to use some idea to control the emitters, to make most of them be off at any time. We did something called YFP reactivation, but we didn't use an acronym with it. So this was forgotten, no acronym, right? So to correct that, I'll give you one more new acronym that's independent of mechanism, single molecule active control microscopy, or SMACM. So that's just, of course, a joke. The key point is many different mechanisms enable this idea. Now, I want to make sure that everyone in the room understands how this works. I want to make sure that we all understand. So let me give you one more analogy. A firefly analogy. I'm sure you've heard of fireflies, these beautiful little flies that fly around and they make light. They blink on and off. Their light is intermittent, okay? And so here's how you achieve super resolution. So I'm just going to explain it. Think of the fireflies, though. Suppose you want to see the branches of a tree, and it's nighttime, however. It's also winter, so there are no leaves. You just want to see the branches of the tree, but it's night. You can't see the tree. What you do then is you place fireflies all along the tree. You make fireflies sit on the branches of the tree. And then you simply watch what's happening. And now you will see the fireflies turning on and off and on and off. And as you each time you see a firefly, you record, oh, there's that. That's a part of the tree. 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 And then you take all of that information and put it together, and you will see the branches of the tree. So that's a way to think about what we're doing with single molecules, but we're doing it on the nanoscale, because each molecule, each label, each fluorescent molecule is about 1 nanometer in size. So I'll show you. Now we're on the cellular scale. This is 2 microns here. And this is a picture of the cell. And all of these spots are coming from a fluorescent molecule that's attached to tubulin. Tubulin, which is one of the elements of microtubules, these cytoskeletal proteins that form a structure inside the cell. One frame of the movie just sees those molecules. And on the right, you can see many white spots. Those are the positions of all of these molecules. Next frame of the movie, you see different molecules and more spots. Next frame, more molecules, more spots. Next frame, more molecules and more spots. And this is really just like the lightning bug story that I just told you about. Now you look at the whole movie and you see that the detail that's appearing is spectacular. Far higher resolution than you have from a diffraction-limited image. This is how this all works. this is one of the cells-like cells in our body, what we call a eukaryotic cell, or mammalian cell. I want to show you how this works also in bacteria, because they're very tiny, and I'm going to use, in this case, the labels are this enhanced yellow fluorescent protein, which is fused to a particular bacterial protein. This is a white light image of the cells. You can see different bacteria here. This is the fluorescence from those cells, and this is the fluorescence movie. It's spectacular, blinking individual fluorescent proteins. And the light from those individual fluorescent proteins, each of which is 3 nanometers in size, is information about the positions of molecules inside the cells. So we use that kind of data and apply it to 3 different proteins here. These are 3 different proteins in 3 different bacterial cells. With the diffraction-limited movie, you see almost nothing. It's all too blurry. But when you use super resolution, voila. you see incredible improvement in the ability to observe structures inside these bacterial cells. So it's very much like a veil being lifted off of our eyes and when you see data like this. This is the one that I showed you before. This particular protein called HU binds to the DNA at many nonspecific locations. So this is a record of where the DNA is inside the cell. The resolution here is about 40 nanometers. So whereas in this picture, it's 250 nanometers, here the resolution is about 40 nanometers. It's an incredible improvement. And that's why everyone is excited about this field. Well, we can do this in three dimensions as well. So here's three dimensions with another crazy acronym. Don't worry about it. But the three-dimensional movie gives you a lot more information because we are interested in the world, which is three-dimensional, not just two-dimensional. And we have special optical methods for achieving three-dimensional information. Here, the bacterial cells have a protein inside that's labeled in yellow and orange, red and orange. So that's making a helical-like structure. And we've also imaged the surface of the cells, the surface of the bacteria, using another fluorescent molecule, and we color that in white and gray. So I want to give you even a couple more examples of super-resolution imaging in cells, because nowadays there's been an explosion of people measuring different structures inside cells with these methods. Here's a couple. On the left, I'm showing a cell that is diseased with Huntington's disease, which is caused by a protein called Huntington, which aggregates inside the cell, sticks together to form fibrils. Previous experiments only found these very large inclusion bodies, very sort of bright patches. But look what super resolution can show you. Many, many tiny fibrils all around inside the cell that are so small that they're below the diffraction limit and so not observable without these methods that I've described. On the right, I'm showing you a neuronal-like cell. And so this is like an axon extending out from a cell body, which is far away. The axon is being shown by a method that allows us to use fluorescent molecules to show you where channels are, where ion channels are located on the surface of the cell. And we not only have this single image where there is many points on it, but we can do this as a function of time. We can get some time-dependent dynamics if we keep doing the experiment again and again. And so here is the movie of the changes in the shape of that cell as a function of time measured by super resolution. The resolution of this particular movie, the time resolution, is about 500 milliseconds. And you can see structures growing and disappearing. They're called neuritic growths. This is a living cell, and so it produces these extensions and then retracts and extensions and retracts, trying to find other cells to communicate with. So this is the beauty of the light from the single molecules that lets you see this dynamic behavior of a living cell far beyond the diffraction limit using light, using visible light. So I want to now end with a quote from another one of those great famous physicists of the 1800s, James Clerk Maxwell, who said, "Conclusions which we have drawn from our experience of bodies consisting of an immense number of molecules may be found not to be applicable to the more delicate observations and experiments which we may suppose made by one who can perceive and handle the individual molecules," and goes on. It sort of repeats itself several times. But the point that I believe you understand, even Maxwell realized that it would be fantastic to be able to observe individuals. Well, now I would like to provide some final thoughts and encouragement to you. Many of you, of course, have seen the Nobel Medal. You see Alfred Nobel's likeness on the front of the medal. But I wonder how many of you have seen the backside of the medal. Not so many, right? The backside of the medal is a beautiful, beautiful work of art. Here, shown on the left, is Natura, nature. Nature carries a cornucopia, okay? And on the right is Scientia, that's science on the right, who is lifting the veil off of nature. It's truly beautiful. It's an inspiring, beautiful photograph. This happens to be Linus Pauling's, but mine looks exactly the same. in any case, what I've tried to convey to you today is that light helps to lift the veil of nature. In addition, I'm excited about all of this work because science provides a rational and predictive way to understand our world. And continued technological advance depends upon continued basic fundamental research, such as that done here at Collège de France and many other places all over the world. So we must help encourage young people to study science. These days, there's not as many young people as interested in science as there should be. Yet, we need, for our continued technological advance, continued basic and fundamental work, because the work I talked to you about single molecules, started over 25 years ago at low temperatures, liquid helium temperatures, a very esoteric, basic, fundamental science experiment. And we had no thought that those single molecules from 1989 would lead to this incredible improvement and advance to see single molecules at room temperatures and in living cells beyond the diffraction limit. So we need to encourage our young people to ask how things work. I want to end by acknowledging many past students, postdocs, and collaborators. Here's my current group of students. I want to thank our funding agencies. And I want to point out we have a logo that's called the No Ensemble Averaging logo, which means single molecules, of course. And by the way, I call it the guacamole team. What does that mean? Well, of course, one molecule is one guacamole. That is one over avocado's number of moles, okay? One over NA moles. So with that very bad joke, let me say merci beaucoup.